Welcome back to Core Brief. I'm your host, and today we're working through a dense but clinically actionable set of findings: mitochondrial dysfunction as a root cause driver of burnout, the neurophysiology of expectation and adherence, a critical safety flag on an emerging investigational agent, and updated outbreak data that should change what you're saying to patients this week. Let's get into it. We're going to open today where the evidence demands we open, with the global immunization picture, because this is time-sensitive practice intelligence. Dr. Sanya Nishtar, CEO of Gavi, speaking at CSES just this month, confirmed what many of us have been watching build for the better part of a year. Canada has lost measles elimination status as of 2025 into 2026, and the United States and Mexico are both at risk of losing elimination status later this year. Let that land for a moment. Canada, a high-income country with infrastructure, cold chain, and distribution capacity. This is not a supply failure story. This is a vaccine confidence failure story. And that distinction matters enormously for how we counsel patients. In conflict-affected settings like Sudan, the mechanism is access-driven. DTP coverage has fallen because the health system infrastructure is fractured. In Bangladesh, a measles outbreak in 2025 and 2026 has a similar structural driver. But in Canada, in the US, in Mexico, the proximate cause is misinformation and erosion of vaccine confidence. Different mechanism, different intervention. When you're sitting across from a vaccine-hesitant parent, you are not solving a logistics problem. You are solving a trust and information problem. And the most concrete, current, proximate example you have is Canada's elimination status, a country demographically and culturally legible to most of your North American patients. That's a real teaching moment. While we're in the immunization domain, one more critical counseling update. The RTSS and R21 malaria vaccines, the first vaccines ever developed against a parasitic pathogen, are now deployed across 25 African countries. This is a genuine landmark. 30 years of development, multi-country randomized controlled trials demonstrating reductions in all-cause pediatric mortality. Evidence grade B, with real-world implementation data still maturing. But here is the clinical imperative for travel medicine and diaspora care. These vaccines target the pre-erythrocytic stage of Plasmodium falciparum. They do not prevent transmission. Bed net use and indoor residual spraying remain non-negotiable. They are not substitutable by the vaccine. When you're counseling a patient traveling to or visiting family in an endemic region, that sentence needs to be explicit. The vaccine does not replace vector control. Full stop. And one structural note on outbreak preparedness relevance beyond low-income settings. Gavi maintains 5 strategic stockpiles: cholera, yellow fever, meningitis, Ebola, and Mpox. And these stockpiles are globally accessible. They are not restricted to Gavi-eligible countries. All 5 are currently reduced due to funding constraints following a roughly $1.9 billion shortfall at the June 2025 replenishment conference. A $500 million first response fund was activated within 3 days of WHO pre-qualification of the Mpox vaccine during the 2024 emergency. The conversion of that fund to a pandemic-level surge facility is being advanced right now at the World Bank spring meetings this April. Reduced stockpile capacity is not someone else's problem. It is a global outbreak response vulnerability relevant to every provider and every country. Now let's move into the mechanistic territory, and this is where today's brief gets dense, so I want to walk through it carefully. The central framework comes from Dr. Scott Scher, a functional and integrative medicine clinician, speaking on the doctor's pharmacy. The clinical construct is what he calls a bidirectional SNS mitochondrial dysfunction loop, mediated by the cell danger response, the CDR. I want to be precise about evidence grading here before we go further. This is expert opinion with mechanistic plausibility. There are no randomized controlled trials validating the composite protocol as described. The CDR as a biological concept is legitimate peer-reviewed territory, consistent with work by Naviak and colleagues at UCSD. But the clinical application framework Scher describes is hypothesis-generating, not RCT-validated. That said, the mechanistic reasoning is coherent and has direct implications for how we sequence interventions in fatigued, burned-out, and cognitively impaired patients. Here's the framework. There are 2 arms to this loop. The top-down arm is familiar to most of us. Chronic psychosocial stress drives sustained cortisol and catecholamine output, norepinephrine, epinephrine, creating continuous mitochondrial demand signaling that eventually exhausts mitochondrial capacity. That part is well established. The bottom-up arm is where it gets clinically interesting. Environmental toxins, mercury, lead, cadmium, arsenic, pesticides, along with Lyme disease, mold, and mycotoxin exposure, long COVID, insulin resistance, and gut dysbiosis, can directly impair electron transport chain complexes 1 and 2. That impairment reduces ATP output. And insufficient ATP output triggers compensatory sympathetic nervous system upregulation, independent of any psychological stressor. So you have a patient presenting with anxiety, hypervigilance, and autonomic dysregulation, and there's no identifiable psychological precipitant, because the driver isn't psychological, it's metabolic. The catecholamines are compensating for an energy deficit.
Building on that, under chronic stress, the cell shifts from oxidative phosphorylation to glycolysis, a far less efficient ATP production pathway. The cell moves from anabolic to catabolic state, and critically, the energetic demand of chronic stress itself depletes the very mitochondrial cofactors needed for recovery: B vitamins, magnesium, CoQ10, NAD+, glutathione precursors, L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid. The system consumes its own repair substrates. This becomes self-perpetuating. Now, here is the clinical pearl that I want every provider listening to hold on to. If you initiate breathwork, yoga, or meditation as first-line interventions in a severely depleted patient before restoring mitochondrial capacity, you risk producing energy crashes and eroding the therapeutic alliance. The reason is precise. That patient has been compensating for low ATP output with catecholamine tone. You remove the sympathetic drive without restoring the energy capacity, and both compensation mechanisms are simultaneously absent. The patient crashes and concludes that relaxation techniques make them worse. You've lost them. The correct sequencing per Shore's framework is threefold. First, support mitochondrial function through cofactor repletion. CoQ10, magnesium, L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid, NAC, riboflavin, NAD+ precursors, combined with dietary correction. Second, eliminate root cause contributors through medication review and a targeted workup. Third, gradually introduce parasympathetic practices as energy capacity is restored. Sequence matters here.
On the medication review, this is high clinical relevance, and I want to spend a moment here. Statins inhibit CoQ10 synthesis via mevalonate pathway blockade and impair complex 1 and 2 function. Statins are among the most prescribed drug classes in the country. If your fatigued patient is on a statin, that is a mechanistically plausible contributor to the loop you're trying to break. Metformin is a selective complex 1 inhibitor, appropriate for type 2 diabetes management, but the evidence for longevity use is not established, and there's signal from resistance training research that it blunts anabolic response. PPIs deplete magnesium, B12, and zinc through reduced gastric acid, impairing mitochondrial cofactor availability. Oral contraceptives deplete folate, B6, B12, magnesium, zinc, and selenium. Benzodiazepines and alcohol produce long-term GABA depletion via GABA-A agonism, paradoxically amplifying anxiety and worsening sympathetic tone over time. Your medication reconciliation for a fatigued patient is not just a safety checklist, it's a mechanistic root cause screen. Now, let's address methylene blue directly, because this is emerging in clinical conversations and the safety picture in the source discussion was incomplete in ways that matter. At doses of 8 to 25 milligrams per day orally, methylene blue functions as an alternative electron carrier, donating electrons directly to complex 3 and 4, and bypassing dysfunctional upstream complexes at IN2. It also recycles NAD+ and FAD, maintaining electron donor capacity when proximal complexes are impaired. The net proposed effect is restored ATP production and reduced reactive oxygen species generation. At these low doses, there is also MAOA inhibition, which increases norepinephrine and serotonin. At approximately 100 milligrams, MAOB inhibition adds dopamine to the picture. At 50 to 70 milligrams and above, there is proposed antimicrobial activity via intracellular hydrogen peroxide generation. Here is what was not addressed in the source discussion and must be addressed before any clinical consideration. Two critical safety flags. First, G6PD deficiency is an absolute contraindication. Methylene blue causes hemolytic anemia in G6PD deficient patients. Screen before prescribing. This is not optional. Second, serotonergic drug interactions carry clinically significant serotonin syndrome risk. MAOA inhibition at any dose creates a dangerous interaction with SSRIs, SNRIs, tramadol, triptans, linezolid, and MAOIs. Review the complete medication list before any consideration of initiation. Additionally, pregnancy and lactation safety is not established. Dose-dependent methanoglobulinemia risk at very high doses. And from a sourcing standpoint, only pharmaceutical-grade, third-party verified product with a transparent certificate of analysis should be considered. Manufacturing contamination with heavy metals is a documented risk in the supplement market. I'll also note explicitly, Dr. Scher holds the position of Chief Medical Officer at Proscriptions, which manufactures methylene blue products discussed in the episode where this framework was presented. All efficacy claims warrant independent verification against primary literature. Weight commercial relationships accordingly. Evidence grade for the composite methylene blue protocol as described, expert opinion only. No RCTs for this indication. Proceed with appropriate clinical conservatism. Let's move to something that's more immediately actionable in every clinical encounter you have this week, the neuroscience of expectation and its implications for how you communicate with patients. Dr. Andrew Huberman, summarizing work from Dr. David Robson's research compiled in The Expectation Effect, describes two studies that should reshape how we think about patient communication. The first involves self-reported gluten intolerance. Participants without biological gluten intolerance were fed identical gluten-free meals, but told the meal contained gluten. They developed diarrhea, hives, and measurable inflammatory responses. The nocebo effect here is not subjective reporting. It operates through identifiable physiological pathways.
More importantly for our purposes, a randomized control trial examining VO2 max and genetic expectation. Participants were randomized into two groups regardless of their actual genotype. One group was told they carried a gene variant associated with enhanced CO2 offloading and oxygen uptake. The other was told they did not. The result? Participants who were told they had the advantageous variant, even when they didn't, demonstrated lower lactate threshold, lower heart rate, improved CO2 offloading, and higher oxygen uptake compared to actual carriers who were told they lacked the gene. Expectation outperformed genotype. The confidence interval on what we tell patients about what to expect is clinically meaningful. Huberman connects this directly to dopamine reward prediction error physiology. When an expected reward is not received, dopamine drops below baseline. Not back to baseline. Below it. That is a worse motivational state than having never received a promise at all. The clinical implication is not a communication nicety. It is neurobiologically precise. Over-promising treatment outcomes does not just disappoint patients, it blunts their future dopaminergic engagement with the therapeutic process. It trains them, physiologically, to expect failure. Under-promise and over-deliver is not just good bedside manner, it is dopaminergically optimal. For patients arriving with histories of multiple treatment failures or dismissed symptoms, and we all have them in our panels, they arrive with pre-trained low dopamine expectations of healthcare encounters. Re-engagement requires explicit acknowledgement of prior failures without defensiveness, conservative and specific outcome commitments, milestone-based monitoring structure to create achievable positive reward prediction events, and effort-first framing, where patient-generated effort precedes provider-assisted reward. That alignment maps directly onto long-term behavioral maintenance. Before we close, one brief evidence-based note on cold water immersion, because it maps onto everything we've discussed today about ANS regulation and dopamine rebalancing. At approximately 60 degrees Fahrenheit, 15.5 Celsius, for 45 to 60 minutes, deliberate cold water immersion produces a sustained, non-spiking dopamine arc, not a spike and crash, a long, shallow elevation that Huberman, citing Dr. Anna Lemke at Stanford, describes as appropriate for daily use in dopamine rebalancing protocols. Cold exposure simultaneously activates peripheral and central catecholamine systems, adrenal epinephrine and locus coeruleus norepinephrine. What makes the intervention clinically interesting beyond dopamine is the stress inoculation dimension. Volitional cold exposure trains the patient to maintain cognitive and behavioral function during a high adrenal state by preserving their sense of agency. That transfer generalizes. It is one of the few single modalities that simultaneously addresses ANS dysregulation, dopamine rebalancing, and stress inoculation, making it a high-yield tool for the wired but tired patient profile. Two clinical contraindications worth stating explicitly. First, do not initiate high-intensity cold exposure in patients who have not yet received basic mitochondrial support, per Schur's sequencing logic. Second, and this is a patient safety directive from Huberman, cyclical hyperventilation immediately before or during cold immersion is explicitly contraindicated. This combination is associated with hypoxic drowning deaths in freedivers. It must not be done. For patients who have encountered Wim Hof protocols, this distinction requires explicit patient counseling. Here is your action item for patient care this week. For every fatigued, burned out, or cognitively impaired patient you see, before you initiate any parasympathetic intervention, run a deliberate medication reconciliation through the mitochondrial lens. Statins, metformin, PPIs, oral contraceptives, benzodiazepines. Ask about the bottom-up environmental contributors, toxin exposure, chronic infections, gut symptoms, insulin resistance markers. And before you make any treatment promise, pause and ask yourself whether your framing is dopaminergically sound, conservative, specific, milestone-based. Give them something they can achieve, and let them exceed it. For every vaccine-hesitant patient this week, use Canada. That's your anchor. Elimination status lost, in a country like ours. That's what herd immunity thresholds look like when confidence erodes. And for every patient headed to a malaria-endemic region, the vaccine does not replace the bed net. Say it explicitly. Continue the practice. See you at the next round.